Thank you for downloading the IA podcast. You can listen to all our episodes on Podbean, Spotify, Apple, and YouTube. Enjoy. Hello, my name is Kieran Neild Alley. I am Communications and Marketing Assistant at the IA, and I'm here with my colleague Mark Glendenning, who is Head of Cultural Affairs at the Institute of Economic Affairs, to discuss the Frankfurt School. In the last few years, we have seen a culture war erupt in our schools, universities and public bodies. It has been characterised by a battle between, on the one hand, the new ultra-left and those, on the other, who champion culturally and politically liberal values such as freedom of speech. Many on the new left have decided to fight the culture war because there are systemic structural biases that mean allegedly that members of ethnic and religious minorities, women, the disabled, amongst others, are collectively oppressed by those said to have privilege, principally white men. This worldview is a direct threat to the values of the European Enlightenment and the Western tradition of liberal democracy, predicated upon the idea that society should be seen rather as a collection of individuals who should possess equal political and legal rights. A prime example of the anti-liberal mindset of the new ultra-left in action was the decision of the Oxford Student Union to set up a student consultancy of sensitivity readers to vet what student papers published in order to ensure that no problematic or insensitive content appears. But how did we get here? Why have forces on the left begun to wage a so-called culture war? Many of these answers lie in an understanding of the Frankfurt School, which Mark and I will address today. The Frankfurt School is important to our understanding of the culture war because it can explain key strains of thought advocated by the contemporary far left. Firstly, the notion that free speech is a tool wielded by people of power and privilege against those in less privileged positions. Secondly, it explains attacks on Western Enlightenment values such as individuality, reason and knowledge. It also allows us to understand what seems a relentless campaign by a loud minority to change society without articulating a credible alternative. The Frankfurt School were responsible for leading academics on the left to abandon classical Marxism and embrace a post-Marxist vision of the world, one in which economic determinism was replaced by a more generalised cultural conception of oppression. I will begin with an introduction to the Frankfurt School, wherein Mark will address critical theory. Then I will address the use of psychoanalysis before we move on to the aestheticization of politics thesis. Thereafter, we will discuss the Frankfurters' move to America and their analysis of mass culture, the rejection of traditional Western conception of rationalism, and then the late Frankfurt School attack on the liberal understanding of democracy. In the aftermath of World War I, a beleaguered Germany came to terms with its defeat. The nation was engulfed in social and economic upheaval, with bands of revolutionaries on the march. Marxist intellectuals were convinced that the conditions were right for a revolution, which Marx had predicted, and the German people would follow in Russia's footsteps. Instead, to the frustration of Marxist intellectuals and communists in Germany, the capitalist system was not destroyed, and a fractured left failed to bring the utopia of revolutionary socialism to their country. Why? This was the question a group of Marxist intellectuals aimed to answer. The Institute for Social Research was established at Frankfurt University, or the Frankfurt School as they became so known, would endeavour to understand why the revolution did not take place, shifting the left's emphasis away from narrow economic determinism. The Frankfurters can be seen as working in tandem with Antonio Gramsci, the Italian communist intellectual who, in the very different circumstances of his own country, was also trying to devise a new culture-based strategy for socialism. This approach would later be characterised by the radical German student leader of the late 1960s, Rudi Dutschke, as the long march through the institutions. The emphasis from now on would not be a single violent uprising of the working class, but a slow takeover of the society's key cultural and political institutions from the inside by elite-level activists. Gramsci had made a distinction between a violent war of movement and a war of position, the latter being based upon the creation of a new intellectual philosophical hegemony, a new conception of common sense. Likewise, the Frankfurters developed their own ideological approach, critical theory, to understand the capitalist and liberal status quo. This would provide a comprehensive critique of capitalism and liberal democracy in its entirety.
Critical race theory, together with some forms of feminism, transgenderism, among other new left-derived narratives, we would argue, are all offshoots and updates of critical theory. They all follow in its tradition, its desire to trash in its totality the society we live in. When Max Horkheimer became the director of the Frankfurt School in 1931, he initiated the work that Herbert Marcuse and others would later take forward in the context of post-war America with the development of a new revolutionary strategy. I believe that critical theory has five main defining aspects. First, for the Frankfurters, capitalism didn't just oppress people economically, but throughout all areas of human existence, psychologically, sexually, culturally. Capitalism gave rise to a bourgeois culture that led to what they called the administered society. The system had created technologies of mass production, and this in turn resulted in human beings becoming machine-like entities. These same producers had also become consumers and, as a result, psychologically enslaved through a fetishization of consumer objects. Capitalism was a society of alienated beings whose lives had no meaning, the Frankfurt School thinkers asserted in their characteristically superior middle-class manner. This view contrasted with that of classical Marxists, who saw capitalism as a progressive development, a necessary transition from the pre-modern world of feudal and agrarian production. By comparison, the Frankfurters saw industrial society in almost romantic, old Tory terms, as an existential form of oppression. Today, this type of critique has an overlap with the anti-capitalism of the Greens and Extinction Rebellion. It also, it must be said, overlapped with that of Germanic fascism, which portrayed American-style mass consumer capitalism as a soul-destroying and banal form of existence. In this regard, for example, there is a major similarity between the analysis of the Nazi philosopher Martin Heidegger and that of the Frankfurters, though the latter, of course, were not anti-Semites. Second, critical theory also departed from classical Marxism because it viewed the cultural dimension of existence as a superstructure of the capitalist economic base, a byproduct that would automatically become transformed to the good once a socialist economic revolution had taken place. The Frankfurters believed that it could not be assumed that the consciousness of the proletariat was determined by the forces and relations of economic production. Rather, they argued that cultural factors such as the authoritarian structure of the family and art, the mass media, and the emerging entertainment industry corrupted the working class. It made proletarians supposedly psychologically passive rather than proactive. It took away their agency. In this way, the Frankfurt School replaced economic with cultural or ideological determinism. The sphere of ideas and speech became a zero-sum game, a will to power between mutually exclusive interests and groups. This type of elitist left-wing approach, which attributes false consciousness to the working class and provincial people, is, of course, still evident today with the idea of unconscious bias, so beloved by the likes of Prince Harry and Meghan. This is also seen with the theory that we are socially constructed by dominant ideologies, the propagation of fake news, and the supposed mind-bending powers of the mass media in general, particularly the tabloid press. This is why the contemporary illiberal left is so obsessed with extending state control of the media, imposing censorship in universities, and throughout wider society. Third, critical theory led to a direct attack upon the notion of reason and the intellectual and political legacy of the Enlightenment. According to the Frankfurters, in the bourgeois world, knowledge is used to overcome technical problems, advance the society scientifically through instrumental reason. This constituted, they said, traditional theory. It was concerned with developing fragmented areas of knowledge designed to overcome particular problems. What theoretical work should, they believe, really be deployed towards was the collective advance of the society as a totality, and this meant the destruction of the status quo in its entirety. Rationality, in the Enlightenment sense of the term, had to be sacrificed for revolutionary change. Knowledge and what is communicated more generally cannot, according to this perspective, be politically neutral. Theory is either traditional, in which case it serves the system, or, on the other hand, critical, whereby it serves the cause of radical change. This is a highly authoritarian and sinister mindset, and we see echoes of it today with the desire to see all academic work in politically partisan terms, hence demands to impose upon academic departments the so-called decolonizing of the curriculum. Critical race theory and other identity politics derived approaches. Even silence is said to be akin to violence. This is an ideology that does not tolerate diversity of opinion. Fourth, the Frankfurt School started from the premise that humans, to go back to my first point, are not autonomous beings in the way liberalism and the European Enlightenment had assumed. Rather, we are beings determined by our cultural environments and by the oppressive nature of advertising, the entertainment industry, the expression of sexist and racist ideologies. Only through the collapse of the existing order will there be the possibility of a state of liberation. The totalitarian politics inherent in the theories of the Frankfurt School, despite the superficially liberatory-sounding language they used, can be linked to the idea that humanity could only be made free through the imposition of a completely altered environment. This would involve the abolition of private property and what they thought of as bourgeois liberalism in all its manifestations, including the free and equal expression of competing beliefs. And this brings us to the fifth and final point. The Frankfurters did not articulate an alternative to the alleged horrors of the status quo. They were remorselessly oppositional and confrontationally negative, as the term critical theory itself suggests. The Frankfurt School appreciated that it was easier to build a broad coalition for change based around the harnessing of dissatisfaction, resentment with various aspects of society, rather than to mobilize a movement around a clear positive objective. In comparison, old-style Marxists were unambiguous about the society they wanted to see succeed the market economy. They envisaged a centrally planned society, while the moderate social democratic left wanted to modify capitalism through reform and a redistribution of wealth. By contrast, today, groups like Extinction Rebellion and Black Lives Matter demand the destruction of the capitalist system, the abolition of the police, and say they want to see liberal democracy replaced, but fail to articulate what the alternatives they envisage actually are, how their fantasy society would actually work.
The first main task for the Frankfurt School was to explain the rise of fascism in Germany. The Frankfurt School had to come to terms with the fact that the German people chose authoritarianism over the supposed communist utopia, and in doing so had to explain the rise of fascism. Some of the Frankfurt Schoolers sought to explain fascism in terms of psychology. Wilhelm Reich wrote The Mass Psychology of Fascism in 1933, arguing that the reason why German fascism or Nazism was chosen over communism was because of increased sexual repression in Germany, as opposed to Russia. As children, members of the German proletariat learned from their parents to suppress nearly all sexual desire and, instead, expend the repressed energy into authoritarian idealism. Reich said in his book, "In brief, the goal of sexual repression is that of producing an individual who is adjusted to the authoritarian order and who will submit to it in spite of all misery and degradation." Reich also famously took aim at the family as the first cell of the fascist society, arguing because the family itself is caused by the authoritarian system, the family becomes the most important institution for its conservation. In this connection, Reich is building on the findings of Morgan and Engels in The Origins of the Family. In this structure, the father is the first dictator, and throughout adulthood, we seek to find the strength and authority of a father in our leaders. In 1933, that was Adolf Hitler. This psychological approach to politics is a major feature of the contemporary left's tendency to weaponize mental health. Today, a major justification for censorship is the allegedly negative mental health effects freedom of speech can have if hear inconvenient and opposing beliefs. Mental health is also used as a justification for an intervention to alter our social environment.
The attempt of the Frankfurt School to explain the failure of Marxism within the interwar Germanic world led to one of their most interesting areas of study. Walter Benjamin argued that the success of National Socialism could in part be explained by its aestheticization of politics. In his book, The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, he argued that technology meant that works of art that were once the preserve of the elite could now be reproduced easily and were accessible to the masses. This meant that politics was becoming increasingly intertwined with art, and that the possibility for propagandizing ideologies and regimes would only grow. The argument advanced here was that through the use of rituals, parades, rabble-rousing rhetoric and film, the Nazis and fascists were able to symbolically give immediate expression to spiritual needs and emotional impulses. Aesthetics in this context was defined as forms of communication that intended to immediately arouse political passions and to irrationally attach certain positive values to a political movement or regime. Likewise, such techniques could be employed to provoke negative associations in the minds of the recipients about political enemies and groups of people. In recent times, we have seen this arguably with the way in which some within the Remain campaign characterized verbally and visually those who voted Leave as racists and ignorant Little Englanders. Likewise, critical race theory demonizes all individuals who so happen to have pale-colored skin as privileged, and people who disagree with their thesis as defenders of white supremacy, regardless of their ethnicity. With the development of social media, is it the case that politics today is becoming increasingly based upon the attempt to trigger emotional responses to particular briefly articulated positions and images rather than build support around more complex lines of argument? The aestheticization of politics is possibly a phenomenon that benefits those advancing authoritarian and collectivist politics because such people promise a godlike central agency that can, in theory, act decisively to deliver an objective or focus hostility on particular persons and groups of people. This type of politics is easier to deliver symbolically because it is sharper, more simple to communicate.
So as we look at culture and the aestheticization of politics, a key moment in the Frankfurt School is their escape to the US. So to rewind, the Frankfurt School began to see culture as the new battleground to win the revolution. Culture had created a false consciousness amongst the workers, concealing the proletariat's exploitation by the bourgeoisie. Mass consumerism and commodity fetishism created this false consciousness, establishing what Gramsci called cultural hegemony over the masses. As you said, Mark, the Frankfurt School believed forms of art and communication had manipulated people into dull conformity. Hollywood and popular culture in general, including Walt Disney cartoons and easily listening music, were on the analytical hit list for the Frankfurters. The popular culture industry were akin to factories producing standardized cultural goods, such as films, radio programs, magazines, and so on, were all sinister forces for a brave new world type of mass passivity. It all led to the cultivation of false psychological needs. But arguably now, we see entertainment as a main vessel in which the cultural left see their ideas pushed into the public consciousness. Is mass culture today really a guise for capitalist values? Today, the film industry and the big tech companies, alongside major corporations in general, are more likely to push woke values and seek to suppress views assumed to be right-wing or in any way transgressive of the dominant new left ideology.
The anti-liberal implications of Frankfurt School thinking came to an overt head in the 1960s with Herbert Marcuse's theory of repressive tolerance. What seemed at the time as a very outlandish concept is in danger of now becoming a mainstream position. Marcuse argued in One Dimensional Man that the forces of revolution should focus on what he called the Great Refusal, a nihilistic rejection of the existing society, not advocacy of a socialist utopia. Structural racism became one of the late Frankfurt School's great themes, the charge that 1960s America was, in reality, another version of Nazi Germany. Marcuse's 1965 essay, Pure Tolerance, is the key to understanding why some of those on the contemporary left disparage the very idea of free speech. Tolerance in a bourgeois society is an illusion, he argued, a more subtle form of authoritarian repression. Those seeking to change the society have the right to use violence to suppress rival opinions. It was no coincidence that closely linked to the late Frankfurt School was the Black Panther Party through the radical Marxist activist Angela Davis, a student of Marcuse's, who became an academic in her own right. According to Pure Tolerance, in a repressive society, the assumptions and biases of the powerful implicitly privilege those with power. In reality, an apparently equal type of politics just serves to entrench the status quo. People are socially programmed, according to the author, and so liberal democratic structures and principles maintain existing patterns of privilege. There is therefore no such thing as free speech or democracy. According to this double-think, double-speak view of the world, being intolerant therefore actually means being tolerant. Marcuse wrote, "Liberating intolerance, then, would mean intolerance against movements from the right and tolerance of movements from the left. So, heads we win, tails you lose, for the opponents of the radical left." This type of authoritarian attitude is now self-evidently very much part of the makeup of the ultra-new left, though their tactics greatly differ within their coalition of forces. Some, like Extinction Rebellion, have used direct action to stop the distribution of newspapers they disapprove of. This was openly supported last year by tweets from politicians Diane Abbott and Dawn Butler. Militant transgender campaigners have even physically attacked feminists who disagree with them. Others on the more mainstream contemporary left, however, restrict their desire to limit debate to non-violent but nevertheless illiberal procedures such as no platforming, the creation of safe spaces, and the demand for so-called anti-hate speech laws. The principle that there should be a free and open exchange of views is now a minority position on the left. For example, the Labour MP Nadia Whitcomb has said, "We must not fetishise debate, as though debate is itself an innocuous, neutral act. The very act of debate, in these cases, is an effective rollback of assumed equality and a foot in the door for doubt and hatred." The implications of this statement are, arguably, very sinister from a liberal and pluralistic position. She believes that injecting so-called doubt into a public exchange of views regarding an issue that she believes should now be closed is wrong, something to be discouraged. While not all on the new left go along with the very extreme position Marcuse originally articulated, collectively as a movement, they are now a force for restricting rather than expanding the communication of competing beliefs.
So now we turn our attention to the late Frankfurt School and their return to Germany after fascism. They attempted to bring back a sense of the seriousness of their findings in the US, the importance of culture. So their pessimistic worldview did not change. The Frankfurt School found themselves at the forefront of German sociological thinking, bringing their critical theory as an established body of work. In 1961, Marcuse published The One-Dimensional Man, a critique of capitalist and Soviet industrial society. His work argued that critical thinking was under threat because of the systems of control needed to protect the capitalist system, producing one-dimensional thinking. We can see here a clear thread of thought from the assertion of the impotence of the German working class to start a revolution after World War I, all the way to the rise of fascism and mass culture. The Frankfurt School held a fundamentally pessimistic view of the world. However, Jürgen Habermas, who joined the school in 1956, held an opposing view to that of Theodor Adorno and Max Horkheimer. He resisted their defeatism. Adorno and Horkheimer became, together with Marcuse, patron saints of the student movement in the 1960s, but there was a rupture in the relationship. Students wanted to end the consensus culture that had formed following the Second World War, eliminate racial discrimination, and free themselves from the authoritarian rule of the establishment. The Frankfurt School saw this as a chance for their cultural revolution, as the students' aims mirrored their contemporary critique of society. But this was short-lived. What we have to remember is the Frankfurt Schoolers were not the radicals the students thought they were. They started their institute on the back of funding from a millionaire, and they had lived a life of relative luxury in the US. Their pessimism turned off the students, who wanted leadership, were hot for revolutionary action, such as the student riots of May in 1968 in Paris and in other countries during the high point of the counterculture of the late 1960s and early 70s. In one event, students occupied the Institute for Social Research, and Adorno called the police to have them arrested, acting as a bourgeois professor would. This led students to write on the blackboard, "If Adorno is left in peace, capitalism will never cease." So the Frankfurt School lost touch with reality and took their finger off the pulse within the even newer left movement that had emerged at the time. And with that, we see the Frankfurt School, as we have understood it, phase out with the deaths of Adorno, Horkheimer and Marcuse by the late 1970s. This left the door open for Jürgen Habermas to become director of the Frankfurt School. Although he is an important figure in the Frankfurt School, the literature makes the distinction between the canon of thought we have addressed today and that of himself. Unlike his predecessors, he was a defender of the values of Western rationality and the broad legacy of the Enlightenment. He perceived the danger of what he called left fascism within the European radical student movement. In a debate with the aforementioned Rudi Dutschke, he explained why he described the ultra-left as fascist. I quote, "Because of its ideology, a triumphalism of the will, a contemptuous disregard for democratic institutions and processes, and an adventurous willingness to engage in violence, precisely in order to provoke crises inimical to liberal democracy." The Frankfurt School thus ends with the inception of Habermas. The Frankfurt School is vital to understand the culture war we currently see across the Western world. Without an understanding of the move away from classical Marxism to a holistic study of society and capitalism in the form of critical theory, it is hard to explain the ideas which exist in our institutions. We hope you found this podcast useful. Thank you for listening. Thank you for listening. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to the IA podcast on Podbean, Spotify, or Apple. We also upload our podcast on our YouTube channel, IEA London. If you want to help contribute to the IEA's digital output, please support us on Patreon, where you can benefit from exclusive membership perks whilst helping us continue to produce stimulating educational output. To become an online patron, click the link in the show notes.